Welcome to the Golden Mike Podcast, where personal growth simply isn't enough. I'm your host, Mark Cordone, a positive psychology coach, a do-gooder from the island of misfit toys who founded the Joy Revolution. Each week, I'll rap with an extraordinary guest doing extraordinary things through their own revolutionary work to talk about the ups, downs, and all arounds of life. It's my mission to provoke and empower you through increased joy and inspire you to spark your own revolution to change history for the better. Welcome to the most serious happiness podcast in this multiverse. Welcome to the Golden Mike Podcast. All right, what a shaking, everybody. It is Mark Cordone on the Golden Mike Podcast. I hope you're doing well. Hope you're feeling well. We got a good one today. And I don't say that every single episode, but we have a good one. A little bit of everything, right? You want the sexiest man alive, or is that what it was? the People's Magazine Hottest Bachelor? We've got it.
Like that.
you want comedy? You've got it. And if you want some really good conversation around identity, about law, around psychology, we have the perfect person, Dr. Kevin Nadal, professor of psychology at both John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the Graduate Center at the City of New York, received doctorate in counseling psychology from Columbia University, also again in New York, and is one of the leading researchers in understanding the impacts of microaggressions or subtle forms of discrimination. Also at the same time, my goodness, we're going to be talking about two books that are out right now by the time everyone gets this podcast. Queering Law and Order, LGBTQ Communities and the Criminal Justice System. You can find that at kevinnadal.com or Lexington Books. And this will be out by the time the podcast runs. Filipino-American Psychology, A Handbook of Theory, Research, and Practice, second edition. Kevin, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here. So good at catching up. It's been a while.
It has been a while. And I know right before we hit record, I told you how I discovered you. And I don't know how we put videos online before YouTube. But you were singing Avenue Q, I Wish I Could Go Back to College. Actually, it was more like a TikTok because you were like lip syncing it. I am curious, sort of growing up, where you – like what was in your head in terms of what you thought you were going to become versus what you've become now, you know, a stable on television shows, a prolific author. You know, I think you're a comedian at some point too.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I actually do think it must have been YouTube or MySpace videos. I don't even know if that was a thing. I used to do a lot of performance. So when I was in graduate school here in New York, you know, struggling graduate student, they need to make the coin somehow. So I did a lot of performance. And so I did comedy. I had one-man shows. I did cabaret shows, a lot of different things. And so I think that Avenue Q video was from one of my cabaret shows that I had in 2006 at the Duplex in New York. It's been like, quite a ride. I definitely, never knew exactly where I would end up. I was already in graduate school and I was doing a lot of performance. And so the goal was always to, you know, become a psychologist and to become a professor. I didn't know exactly how far it would take me or where I would go. And so it's funny. So a lot of people who meet me or who have met me in the past 5 to 10 years, they have no idea about the performance part unless they happen to stalk me on YouTube or something.
Unless they go deep. Yeah.
But the people who have known me for a while, that's old school. You know some of the beginnings, which, you know, I'm actually quite proud of. When I think about it, I was 20 something year old newbie to New York transplant, originally from California. Uh-huh. And I just decided I wanted to do one man shows, and, you know, people came, which was weird. Like, I was like, I don't know if I heard of a 21-year-old who wasn't from New York who showed up and said, Hey, Filipino community, hey, queer community, I'm doing one man shows. Can you come? Like, I don't think I would go, you know, I'd be like, who is this? And maybe there were people who didn't come and who were like, who is this kid? But, you know, I did pretty well. Like, there were, like, you know, always at least like 100 people at my shows. And so, you know, it was pretty good.
I mean, there was, it was around the 90s. There was a circuit, right? Around the United States of Filipino Americans. And I met you through that circuit of.
Yeah, because you were performing too. Yeah.
I was performing too. Yeah. I was in a band back then, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing that was a little bit different was when I went into my doctoral program. Mm-hmm. I wanted to hide all that.
Right.
I wanted to hide all of it. And mm-hmm. I didn't want my professors to see and stuff. And now it's something that I'm really happy that I can show my son. I can show, you know, I'm just really happy that I don't have to be seen as this sort of one-sided, one-dimensional person, you know? Mm-hmm. And also at the same time, it was, there was a lot of voice finding through the mm-hmm. arts. I don't know if I would have been on a podcast like this if I hadn't started by kind of putting myself out there, you know? How much of what you did back then informs what you do now with sort of the queering law and order book and the Filipino American psychology book?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's all very much related. I mean, I think mm-hmm. From on the most like basic level, like being mm-hmm. a performer informs my ability to be an educator, you know, mm-hmm. having the experience of trying to keep people's attention, trying to keep people entertained, trying to impart some sort of message in a way that is relatable or digestible. That's essentially what teachers do, what professors do, what educators do. And so, you know, some of those different skill sets that I had developed over time, you know, definitely still are part of, you know, my current professional identity and career. But, you know, in terms of even just like the types of things that I talked about were always related to psychology and society and social justice and that sort of thing. Like my one-man shows weren't just me just cracking jokes. It was, you know, me talking about like being Filipino and being queer and navigating life in New York post 9/11 and, you know, everything from like dating to relationships to, you know, being the only Filipino in certain spaces, and being a queer person of color, being one of the only in certain spaces. So that's very much related to psychology. So I write mm-hmm. about it now in more like academic ways and do empirical research on those topics. But mm-hmm. back then it was like, you know, I was talking about those things just through my own lens and through my own experiences. And, you know, and I think that's something that I would hope more, not just academics, but more people in, you know, various professional, quote unquote, professional careers. I wish that they felt more comfortable feeling connected to, you know, their past artistic selves or still continue their, you know, their current artistic selves. Like your experience of like, you know, wanting to hide all that. Like I had a very similar experience. Like my professors at the time, not all of them, but some of them like kind of reprimanded me for doing that, you know? Part of that is because, you know, psychology is supposed to be like these, you know, blank slate kinds of people and not supposed to encourage your, you know, like your clients to look you up or know anything about you. But that's also very like white Western standards, right? Like for me, like for psychology, psychologists to be more effective, they actually should be, you know, in touch with their identities and be able to talk about issues related to race and justice. And when you think about like Filipino communities, particularly where there's so much shame and stigma in even seeking therapy, if that person is cold or if that person isn't able to, you know, reflect a story every once in a while about their own personal experiences, then, you know, they're not going to be able to build that rapport or that trust. So I'm like, let's you know, disrupt what the notions are of being a professor, a psychologist, a engineer. That we are all, you know, very multifaceted and have many intersectional identities that are very important to who we are. And we shouldn't be like the white people who, you know, or not necessarily white people, but white culture and sure. Western standards in which we have to separate all of these things.
Yeah. And definitely through my 20s and 30s, and even into my 40s, I still catch myself with an either or type of thinking. Mm-hmm. Either I have to choose to put myself out there and, you know, professionally be respected, or I do what I love in hiding. Right. And it's not an either or. And that's what, at least speaking in the eye, it's not either or for me. And I do love the fact that it is, you talk about it being kind of a disruptive thing to be vulnerable, you know, but you can stay powerful and vulnerable at the same time. You can mm-hmm. still stay sovereign. And when I saw that your book was informed by intersectionality in queer theory, first thing I thought about was Audre Lorde's notion of the mythical norms, right? White, mm-hmm. thin, male, young, heterosexual, Christian, mm-hmm. and financially secure. And that was sort of the archetype of the norm. And then everybody else was a deviation of it, mm-hmm. not good enough for it. Is that your intention in terms of putting queering law as the title?
Yeah, I mean, so yeah. Definitely shout outs to Audre Lorde, shout outs to Sojourner Truth, shout outs to Kimberly Crenshaw, mm-hmm. who coined the term intersectionality. Mm-hmm. But essentially, you know, you're right on target. This idea of disrupting what notions are of what is normalized, and starting with, you know, understanding that when we think about people from historically privileged groups, we oftentimes view them not only as the norm, but as like the standard, the which we have to achieve or should try to achieve to be like, or to succeed to be like. And, you know, for some people, like, not only is that impossible, but it's also very stressful, and it comes with a lot of consequences. It comes with this idea of, like, you know, losing part of yourself, leaving your identity at the door. And that's not something that's positive. And so queering law and order, it takes some of those intersectionality pieces, and also takes what is core to queer theory. Queer theory is based on the notion of queering as a verb, or disrupting socialized standards. And so, you know, initially thought of as queering, like what is thought of as normal, considering sexual orientation and gender identity and gender presentation. But essentially, like, you know, queering up all of the status quo, queering up, you know, things like, you know, what a professor or what an academic looks like, to even queering up, like, why do we teach our kids that everything is black or white or good or bad, or that, you know, there are certain standards. You know, I catch myself, like, you know, in interacting with my kids, or like with people in general, just like our children in general, just this idea of, like, you know, why do I push for girls to like things that are quote unquote girly? Why do I push for boys to like things that are more masculine? And that's because I've been socialized. We're the products of socialization. Yeah. So even if I am someone who considers myself, you know, a little bit more social justice oriented or quote unquote woke as can be, that still comes with, like, you know, at least 20, 30 years of not questioning that. So that's why. So queering law and order, you know, to go back to the original question, is to queer the ways that we look at the criminal justice system. Why are certain things viewed as criminal? Why are certain things, why are certain people oftentimes made vulnerable by the justice system? Why are certain people made to experience violence as a result of the criminal justice system, and by government and law and legislation in general?
Yeah, I thought it was a fantastic title, and I also want to go dun dun every time you say it.
Exactly. when I told a few people, they were, who don't, you know, aren't necessarily familiar, and they're like, "Oh, so are you going to talk about the time where it looked like Liv? Is that her name? Liv was gonna do something that looked like she was gay?" And I was like, "No, that's not." I was like, I wish I had time to review 19 seasons of Potential Truth on the show, but that's not what the book is about. But, you know, I do, that's part of the you know, the thing is like, querying Law and Order in general. Yeah.
And what I appreciate about just where the book is, you know, when I was in grad school, it's almost like they would give us all these human development models, and then in like 1 week they'd put like queer theory, negritions, Asian, like they throw them all in, and it was like the week before the final, and they weren't going to ask in the final. You know, and I love the fact that it's upfront.
Yep.
It's boom. It's here, and it could look like a lot of things.
Right. And it should. And I feel like, you know, like I feel like professors particularly, like they have like the power, the opportunity to make it front and center, to not make it an afterthought in week 14, and to do it right, you know, like every single field. I've been saying this a lot ever since George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and all these folks who've been unjustly murdered, is that we can talk about systemic oppression in every single field, every single subject, every single class that's taught, and specifically at college level, but even earlier than that. You could talk about systemic oppression on the first day of class, and that centers that conversation so that it becomes something that students recognize is integral to the entire conversation. Yeah. And, you know, people will often argue with me and say like, well, no, I don't think you could do that like in statistics class. And then I would say, no, you totally absolutely can, because you could recognize that statistics was based on, you know, white male standards, and that a lot of statistics have been used to oppress people of color. A lot of times statistics don't take into account the norms that how a lot of samples are predominantly white and male. White. And so, you know, I go on that, and then they'll say like, well, what about architecture? And I'll say, well, you know, architecture, you could look at how we glorify these white male centered designs that are oftentimes built by people of color. And if you look at some of the earlier architecture in the United States, for example, these beautiful buildings were built by slaves. And so, you know, every single field we can start off by talking about systemic oppression in some way, talking about how the subject or the course content, you know, has been so oppressive towards different people, and still teach the material, but teach it to them in, or teach the traditional material, I should say, but teach them in the way that they're thinking about it more critically. Right? You could teach about psychology and all those things. But for people to say, like at the end, after talking about Freud or CBT or whatever, kind of behavioral therapy, to say like, you know, how does this or this does not apply to people of color or to queer people or to people with disabilities? So it can be done. I just think that professors aren't trained that way. And so they don't do it. And it takes a few brave people to start it and then to teach their colleagues to do similarly.
Yeah, I'm really happy that you brought that up, because you remember I was going to come to New York and talk to you before, you know, things went down the way they did. And I was actually having a conversation with a curator, a speaking curator up there. And he had asked me what he should use as the in terms of the social justice talks. I was like, technically speaking, everything is social justice, man.
Right.
Like, it's not like you take the Asian kid and you take the black person. That's your social justice talk. And in fact, I don't know about you. It feels a little minimizing, being like, hey, here's the person of color here to talk about Native Americans, right? Like that had happened to me in grade school, and I was like, wow, like they're really scooping us up and putting us into in others' category.
And that goes along with what you were saying from Audre Lorde's work. It's like, because it's viewed as an afterthought, because the lens at which they're viewing it is that this colorblind notion is the norm, is the ideal. And so anything that somebody says that has to do explicitly with social justice or identity or anything like that in general is viewed as the other, as opposed to their colorblind view of talking about anything else is, you know, a white male thing versus, you know, a person of color or a queer person or a queer person of color, a woman of color talking about these things. Like it is more likely that that their identities would be more center, or at least the lens through which they talk about anything.
Yeah.
So,
well, I wanted to throw this out as well. Given the backdrop of your book coming out during Black Lives Matter, I think I'd even seen a reference in your book to it. Like, it's so fresh, you know. How can this book be taken in light of the Black Lives Matter movement? And also at the same time, what I noticed was this book is not only for students and teachers. This is a very accessible book.
Yeah. You know, I write about Black Lives Matter. So I've actually published the book. It was supposed to come out in April, but because of COVID, it got postponed, and then it actually ended up coming out in September, October. So, you know, I talk about Black Lives Matter and the movement for Black Lives, you know, which was originally conceptualized in 2014 after the Trayvon Martin case. And so it's really integral into the book. And so, you know, a lot of it's also at the same time, like, I also feel like there, if the book came, if I was able to put in some last minute edits, I could have added more about, you know, all these different movements. But of course, like, you know, that's, you know, it's always in hindsight, or it's impossible to have everything be as up to date as possible. And especially given, like, with book publishing, like, sometimes you'll write something and it won't be published for at least a year or two. But back to your question, like, you know, I write about all the different movements, not just affecting queer and trans people, but how it intersects with, you know, Black Lives Matter, with Indigenous movements, with understanding, you know, experiences of people with disabilities, immigration, et cetera, because all those things matter. And it's not just that all of a sudden we're focusing on these issues after COVID and after the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, but that we're also recognizing that this is part of history. United States, or what is now known as the United States, was historically built on the backs of slaves and on stolen land. And so that's not something that just popped up in 2020. That's something that has been integrated into the entire fabric of this country. And, you know, the colonizers, the settlers that created what is now known as the United States, they did a good job in making it work. They did a good job of trying to, you know, oppress people to the point over generations where people not necessarily don't think they're being oppressed anymore, but where they're convincing the oppressors that this is normal. They're convincing the oppressors that if people of color or people of historically marginalized groups are complaining or are protesting, that they're actually the ones that are, you know, deficient in some ways. They're gaslighting. They've gaslighted all of America. You know, I remember reading this book in college called Lies My Teachers Told Me. later reading, you know, The Real History of the United States, or The People's History of the United States. And then, you know, just reading, learning, having to unlearn all of these things that we had been taught from, you know, Columbus to George Washington to, you know, all these people that founded this country, and Thanksgiving is a peaceful holiday, and you know, like, all of that has really effed us up. And I feel like we need to do our best to change that narrative. You know, no longer should we celebrate the colonizers' narrative, but to celebrate the indigenous narrative that this country is built on stolen land. That needs to be recognized in, you know, real and meaningful ways.
Kevin Nadal dropping the Franz Fanon on us. I'm loving this, man. one of the other things with the book is, but this is actually both books, but we're looking at Queering Law and Order right now. This looks like a topic that, I mean, I see this being a huge volume. And I don't know, I'm sure other people have told you this, but like, I see this like, on any given year in the future, you can add another article or chapter to this. In holding your book now, was there any chapter that you wish that you kept in there, or if you had the chance to put one more chapter in? Because it does go the diaspora of it, from you know, the history, gender and sexuality on trial, locked up in a binary. I mean, it goes wide.
Yeah, you know, there's so much more that I could have included, but I started with this, and thank you for you know, the compliment. I do hope that it becomes something that can have multiple editions, you know, throughout you know, the years. But you know, I kept it short, but it's not. There's a lot of chapters, but I kept it to the chapters that I have based on like what we already know. You know, so for example, like, you know, we know about, or there's at least enough information for me to have provided reviews on, you know, Korean trans people in the court systems, in the prison industrial complex, in experiences with law enforcement. There's a growing amount of literature that you could read about that I include on immigration, on family law, on you know, forensic psychology. So those are some of the things that I included. But you know, there are lots of other things that I could have expanded on. Like, I talk about the history of homophobic and transphobic legislation in our country, ranging from, you know, the sodomy laws to what are masquerade laws, that people had to dress according to their sex assigned at birth, or they would be arrested and jailed, to, you know, the earlier sexual predator laws that by virtue of being queer, that people could be arrested because they would be presumed to be sexual predators. So, you know, those sorts of things I include, but I could have gone into them a little bit deeper, and I hope to go into those a little bit deeper, you know, if given the opportunity. One thing I alluded to that I could have definitely written more about is, you know, just sex work and the notion of sex work being so criminalized and viewed as so immoral, when in reality, like, sex work, as we know, is the oldest profession in the world. But also, why is it so so pathologized, so criminalized? Because of, you know, this Puritan Christian upbringing that the United States has, right? Like, there's really nothing wrong with sex work if it's consensual, if it's safe, and many times trans people and queer people, but trans people more specifically, enter sex work because there are no other options. If they, you know, are unable to get a job, if they don't pass, or are unable to live in stealth, or the ability for people to not know about their gender identity, you know, they don't get callbacks for jobs when they submit applications. They don't, you know, they might have difficulty getting into grad school or school in general. And so there's a lot of these different factors. And so I think that's the next chapter that I would probably write a little bit more about is queering sex work legislation, which people are doing now. There's a lot of great advocates, especially here in New York City, who are trying to change those laws. But it's so hard to change because of these very Puritan views that people have.
Hey, it's Mark. I hope you're digging the Golden Mike podcast. If you have or are just starting your own revolution fueled by joy, there's a site I created for you. If you, like me, believe that personal growth is simply not enough, if you, like me, are committed to changing history for the better in both micro and macro ways, check out joyrevolution.com. In there, you'll find an archive of our over 200 Golden Mike Live Facebook shows and, of course, our podcast that you're currently listening to. Check out the blogs highlighting how positive psychology and joy theory apply to your everyday life. There's even some cool clips from our Joy Revolution course geared towards influencers, speakers, writers, and change agents. It's all there. Go to joyrevolution.com. That's joyrevolution.com. Let's get back to the episode. Kevin, I wanted to ask you this, and oftentimes when I write, it's about things that are very personal to me, and sometimes I can't write because it's too close. It's too close to me. Did you ever find yourself during this book or in Filipino American psychology writing about something that's just like, oh, that I haven't gone through my shit yet to put it out.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you asked that because Queering Law and Order was probably one of the hardest books I've had to write, because it's so personal and it's so painful. Not even necessarily that I had firsthand experienced a lot of these things, but that I could have. That's the kicker, is that I could have. And that, you know, in fact, you know, in my preface, I write about how I feel like I'm a lucky one to be a queer person of color living in the United States and alive in 2020 in my age group. That's something that is rare. And to be this person who is successful in my career, that's rare. I oftentimes talk about like how as a 40-something-year-old queer person of color, I don't have very many queer men of color as mentors. And that's not because people exist and don't want to mentor me, but it's because many of them died. Right? Like when we look at how AIDS affected queer people, especially gay men, trans women, and queer people in general, it wiped out entire generation of queer men of color. And so that feels already so heavy to me. And then when I think, as I was going through, you know, these various parts of history, like looking at things like, immigration law, if you were an out, openly queer trans person, you were not legally able to enter the United States until after 1990. Like, I didn't know that. Like, that's hard.
1990.
Oh. Right. So, of course, we all have our queer titos and titas. They hid it, or, they didn't weren't out completely because that was illegal for them to have immigrated prior to 1990 if they were out. It was viewed as a mental disorder. So to be queer, to be LGBTQ was viewed as a mental disorder. And so that's another thing. If I was born even 20 years earlier, even 10 years earlier, that I could have been diagnosed with a mental disorder and I could have faced things like electroshock therapy or castration or lobotomy because somebody thought that I was mentally ill. It wasn't until 1973 that the American Medical Association said that homosexuality was no longer a mental disorder. I was a kid who was born like a few years after that. So if I was born 10 years earlier, like they could have, done stuff like that to me. Just as a last example, there were stories after stories. I was like, oh my gosh, that totally could have been me. There was a story of a kid who was probably around my same exact age. He was like 20 in the 90s in some, I want to say southern state. He was caught in a car with another young man, and the police officer arrested them. And that guy, the kid, was so ashamed that the police officer would then, out him to his parents, that he went home and died by suicide.
Yeah.
And I remember how shameful it was to be in the closet. So how come, that didn't happen to me, but if I was in that situation, I may have done that, because it was so shameful. I didn't have any support in my early 20s, or at least verbal support, because that was a different time in the 90s. Like, people didn't talk about stuff like that, and people weren't overtly supportive of LGBTQ folks. So it was very, very, very personal. It is traumatizing to write about trauma. But at the end of the day, like I just felt like I had to do it because, if not me at this moment, how long would we have to wait? So that was my motivation to keep on doing it. Because no one has written about these issues through an intersectional lens, especially by a person of color. And I just needed to finish so that people could hear this.
Well, I'm sorry to hear about, it is difficult when you're writing about trauma. And also at the same time, one of the things that I appreciate about this it's not just the attorney's law book. You see at the end of the chapters, there's almost praxis work. for you to take the theory and go out and apply these in little ways to the community. And that's what I really liked about it. And thank you for going through the trauma for us to be able to have the praxis work even, you know.
Yeah. I know, it was harsh, but I'm glad. I'm glad again that you find it useful, and I hope that, you know, people of all, like, you know, professions in all sectors, that they could find some use in it. It isn't just for lawyers, attorneys, like you mentioned. It isn't just for even professors or students. But I hope that even, like, you know, parents who read this could take something from it. I hope that, you know, like, mentors, teachers,
absolutely,
people across, you know, various fields can take something with it. And if anything, like, just to think twice about the ways that we promote heterosexism and cissexism, or promote that, you know, straight heterosexual and cisgender people are the norm.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to throw this piece out as well. When I was reading, I don't know if you know, Kevin, but I like to look at things through a positive psychology bent.
Yeah.
Now, you can totally dismiss it as hokey pokey psychology, but it's really helped me go through some things. And I think that it's been a really cool way to look at social justice. Mm-hmm. And just kind of paging through this from a positive psychology bent, I was like, okay, you know, the medical model often talks about repairing negative outcomes. And the question that came up for me was, well, the criminal justice model is very similar in that there's punishment for those held responsible for bad outcomes. Mm-hmm. What does that look like from a positive psychology bent, if there even needs to be one there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so for, you know, I'm into this positive psychology. I'm not as well-versed in it as you are. But, you know, I am into this idea of, you know, feeling that people can have some control of, you know, the ways that they react to things and that sort of thing. And I also recognize that there are some people of historically marginalized groups, particularly, who might have more difficult time doing that because they keep on, you know, coming up against a lot of these, you know, systemic oppressions.
Yeah.
So the criminal justice system is one that, because it has been built in such a way to oppress so many people, it becomes harder and harder for people to have some of these more, you know, positive outlooks of life, or humanistic, or, you know, having more self-efficacy, because the system is so so criminalizing, you know. I talk about, you know, in my classes, I teach forensic psychology on different levels, graduate and undergraduate level. But I talk about those two systems that you mentioned. So the medical model is one in which people are pathologized, and we look at the pathology instead of the wellness part. We look at the ways in which we need to fix people, as opposed to looking at their strengths. And we also are really focused on, you know, what is called, you know, evidence-based research, and, you know, ways that, what do we know that has worked in the past, and this is what's going to work. And so a lot of people are really into them. You know, obviously there are lots of, you know, positive things about that. But we also know that it is important to focus on wellness and to focus on people's strengths, and that people, particularly of historically marginalized groups, that there's so many different external factors that may contribute to, you know, their current state of being. So I talk about the medical model, and then I also talk about the criminal justice system. So the criminal justice system is one in which we punish people, is one in which we view people as good or bad, or actions as good or bad. We follow what is known as the letter of the law, that this is what the law says. And that is oftentimes not aligned with not just ethics of certain fields, but also not morals. Because you might know that something morally doesn't feel good. So that means spiritually, emotionally, doesn't feel just or right. But because we are following the letter of the law, which is the criminal justice system, that takes precedent. And in this country, at least, that we follow that, even if it doesn't make sense. And even if it doesn't match, you know, what our morals would be. So when you have forensic psychology, you have that intersection of the medical model that pathologizes people and the criminal justice system that criminalizes people. And so to have the wellness model, to have positive psychology, to have social justice awareness, you know, you're going against so many different systems. And if you if you're in environments that, you know, view any of this work as being, you know, hokey, or these are angry people of color, or anything like that, because again, they're focusing through white male lenses, then, you know, it becomes very, very hard to do this work. But if we don't do this work, then we're essentially, you know, complicit to allowing these systems to continue. There's a reason why a majority of people in, I shouldn't say majority, but that there's a disproportionate number of Black people in the criminal justice system, because that's the status quo that has just been accepted, and that has been accepted by law enforcement, by judges, by people in the prison industrial complex, and even by citizens. That is just the expectation of what should happen. And so until people try to, you know, to disrupt that by educating people that Black people are more likely to be convicted of a crime, or twice as likely to be convicted of a crime, the same crime that a white person would experience, or that they would get harsher punishments than a white person, then, you know, that system is never going to change. So we have to continue to educate and fight against that, and to, you know, recognize the role of systems as opposed to the role of individuals who sometimes make bad decisions and sometimes don't, sometimes are convicted wrongfully of things. And, you know, it's so important to look at systems.
Right. I told you, everybody, People Magazine's hottest bachelor in 2000, one of the hottest bachelors in 2006. Andy's got a brain. Amazing. Queering Law and Order, LGBTQ communities and the criminal justice system. It's out right now. I believe you can get it. Lexington Books.
Roman and Little is the publisher. Lexington is a subsidiary of that. You can find it on Amazon and pretty much anywhere. And if it's an academic book, so it's pricier than, you know, I would have liked it to be. So if you can't afford it, I would highly suggest asking your library to pick it up. Because libraries, that's what they do. And in fact, most libraries, people don't utilize that service. So ask your libraries to pick it up. Even if you can't afford it, you ask so that someone else who can't afford it can check it out.
Amazing. Yeah. I also wanted to talk really quickly about a book that will be out by the time we air, which is in its second edition, Filipino American Psychology, A Handbook of Theory, Research, and Practice. Now, I did have this book on me in grad school. And I'm curious as to between the first and second edition of this book, what has changed?
Yeah. So, I mean, thank you for one, supporting the first edition. It's been 10 years since the first edition had been written. And, you know, that was my first book, Filipino American Psychology. And it was based on a lot of my dissertation, because Filipinos had virtually been erased or minimally written about in most fields, but specifically in Asian American psychology, specifically in Asian American studies, and in psychology in general. And so it was really important for me to write this book, because for folks who are familiar with Filipino American experiences, that we have such a unique experience, cultural identity, racialized experience, and a lot of different both strengths and disparities that we experience in ways that other Asian American groups might not necessarily experience. And for many of these socialized experiences are very similar to Black Americans, Latinx folks, Native Indigenous folks, and so forth. And so, you know, it was really important for me to write this book back then. And so when I knew the 10-year anniversary was coming up, you know, I approached the publisher and I said, hey, can we do an update? And they were glad to do so. And so this book basically covers everything that has been written in psychology, at least since then. And it's been, you know, it was really, you know, both fascinating and humbling to see that so many people had written about it. So I'm sure, you know, if you remember, like, if you just clicked on psych info in the 90s and wrote in like Filipino, like there would be like hardly anything, right? And so you had to search in other disciplines, and you had to even sometimes like cite like magazines, which is fine, but it wasn't academic, right? And so many, especially like dissertations and theses, have come out of emerged since its first publication. It was first published in 2009, and then again in 2011, same edition, different publisher. It covers like studies. So, you know, what's funny is like the first edition, I really did a lot of like hypothesizing, because there were things that I knew existed based on not just my own experiences and community experiences, but also like from other disciplines. Like we all know that there are certain gendered experiences of Filipinx folks. We know that there, there's this thing called colonial mentality, or there's this thing called ethnic identity, that was more, you know, theoretical and anecdotal based on personal experience. But since then, there have been so many wonderful scholars, many of them young scholars, who have written about it. So I've been able to integrate more of this empirical literature to support, you know, some of these claims that I have. I also write a little bit more about concepts that, you know, I may not have felt able to write about before, because, it was already so hard to get it published, or it was already so hard to convince people to want to publish it. So I write more directly about things like anti-Blackness. I write more directly about historical trauma, or the, negative effects of colonial mentality. Because before, I feel like I was more, trying to just be factual and academic. But I feel like my voice is a little bit more in here. So, and I've grown, I'm 10 years older. I hope that people can see the difference in the writing.
That's super cool. I mean, I'm so excited that there's a mental health and psychotherapy update on that. I could have used that in grad school.
Right. Yeah. And that's a big part of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
We didn't have that. Like I know a lot of therapists who have the first edition, and they, say that it's helped them a lot, because prior to that, if they wanted to know anything about Filipinos, they would ask like their one Filipino friend, sometimes that person would be me or you, but now they have a book that they can go to and actually refer to
there, and there's empirically driven stuff in it.
Exactly. Yeah.
I also love the fact that you're talking about the Filipino American cultural values, because I'm not sure how articulated it was in the previous book, but I do remember the psych info searches would always come up with Asian American, right. And I always remember being like, it's not the same. It's same. A little bit different,
Right.
It's great that this book is going to be coming out, and that can be found on Amazon. This is Wiley, right?
Yeah, the publisher is Wiley. So you can find them all online. Just Google it, and it'll be out in November. November 18th is the release date.
Okay, Kevin, this is fantastic. You've said it all. I just want to go into a quick lightning round with you.
Sure, let's do it.
And I want to know how you embody joy. And so I'm going to ask you a question. You fill in the blank, all right?
All right.
Okay. Joy tastes like?
Pork, even though I don't eat pork. But that just shows you probably how much I miss it. I'm a Filipino vegetarian with an asterisk. Basically, it means that on special occasions, I will have some pork adobo and tocino and Texas meat. But that's joy. So I have it, every once in a while.
There was a little shame in that joy there.
I know. That's what I'm working through. But it's complex. We're all complex people. It happens.
I've got to see an article about that one, Kevin. All right. Yeah, The next one is joy sounds like.
My son laughing.
Oh, fantastic. Joy smells like?
Lola. I don't know why I said that.
Lola, I don't know why I said that.
I think I started thinking of like Lola sniffing you, like. But I do think there was something very specific about going to my Lola's house, and then it always smelled like food. You know, even when she wasn't expecting us, that was what was the kicker. Was like, you know, we knew she was going to go. We were going there. Like, of course. Yeah. But even like, it was like she was like magic. Like she would start cooking if she even sensed that we were on our way. You know,
she would call you in by starting to cook.
Right. That's why. Maybe the scents were traveling across the freeway, and I love it.
Of her.
Yeah.
So Joy looks like.
People of many different groups, people of color, coming together and celebrating life. So for me, joy was this past weekend after the presidential election was announced, and seeing people of color, mostly Black and brown people, with some white people in there, dancing the electric slide on Black Lives Matter Plaza, with just pure bliss, just so happy.
Amazing. Amazing. Okay. You got one final question.
Okay.
You get this right, Dr. Nadal, and I'll pass you. All right. So joy feels like
a hug, which is so hard to come by these days. Right. I mean, I'm going to get emotional right now. I don't know why, but, I want to hug my friends again. And, you know, I'm grateful that I have a husband and a son who I can hug. But I miss, like, I see my friends once in a while, socially distanced. Yeah. And, you know, it's like I want to hug people again.
Yeah. It sounds like you and I come from a hugging family.
Yeah.
That's big. Yeah. Now, here's the final bonus question. Okay. I won't hold you any longer, but so what I've worked through and now work with people on is this thing called the joy revolution. Mm-hmm. Now a revolution can be a revolution of the heart on the inside, right? Or a revolution can be one that is led, not necessarily in joy every time, but is built with joy, you know, when maybe old systems are taken down, antiquated systems. Mm-hmm. For you, Kevin, what is your joy revolution?
My joy revolution is that people can be activists in all sorts of ways, to the point that we feel freer and that we feel more accepted, more included, and loved. And in being those activists and being those social justice change agents, we work through a lot of our historical trauma of the past, our own personal traumas, to give back to others, to make the world and the planet and society a better place for future generations. And I feel like you have to do that in order to feel that joy, that it's not just a selfish, you know, I want to feel good for myself, but I want to be able to do what I can to make this world a better place. And then in doing so, I can then do the electric slide on Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington, D.C. With other people who are also social justice activists doing the work.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's
love
my
it. Kevin,
revolution.
Amazing. It's been great reconnecting with you. The site kevinnadal.com, it's going to be in the show notes. Hopefully we won't take a 10-year break from talking to each other.
For sure. Hopefully we can see each other in person when we can all travel again and
we
go
will.
Back on the Filipino circuit like we did in the 90s and early 2000s.
That would be amazing. That would be absolutely amazing. Now, on behalf of Kevin and myself, for your sake, for my sake, for goodness sake, start your revolution in love, in light, in shadows, and in joy. Take care, y'all. I hope you enjoyed the Golden Mike podcast. There's more good stuff coming your way. But until the next episode, let's stay in touch, yes? Find us on Instagram as TheJoyRev, TheJoyRev, or communicate with like-minded revolutionaries in our Facebook group. Search The Joy Revolution Underground. And of course, don't forget to check out the classes, articles, blogs, and some serious fun at joyrevolution.com. That's joyrevolution.com. Now, until then, what will you do to change history for the better? Let's go out and play, shall we? Press start to begin.